you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Hello, everybody. It's Jackie, and this is Who Won the Week, Sci-Fi Wire's podcast where we break down the latest in geek news, have fun celebrity interviews, conversations with Sci-Fi Wire staffers, and more. And you know what? The "and more" is really where the fun and the mystery lies, because you just never know. It could be anything. It could be everything. This week, I'm very excited. We have, as always, Alexis Loynaz is joining me to talk about the headlines of the week. He's Sci-Fi Wire's news editor. And we also have Sci-Fi Wire's Brian Silliman. You may know him as the host of Warp Factor. He's going to be here talking to us all about Lower Decks, the new Star Trek animated series. He got to sit down with some of the cast and creators recently for a piece that is going to be up on Sci-Fi Wire over at sci-fi.com, which everyone should check out after listening to this podcast. So we got a ton of stuff coming for you. And as always, at the end, I will crown the winner of the week, this time along with Brian. So stay tuned. It's a very special edition of Who Won the Week at the end of Who Won the Week. But first, we're going to break down all the headlines. Myself and Alexis. Alexis, how are you?
Hello, Jackie.
Hello.
What a week it's been. How are you?
What a week.
What a week.
This is the week of exits. I mean,
this is a week of shakeups, shakedowns, shake left, shake right, whatever you want to shake it up. Everything just shook it up, huh?
Just got shaken like a Kardashian shakes her salad. If anyone listening gets
what
that.
Is it?
They're always shaking their salads. They constantly on. I will say the guiltiest pleasure of my life, and I actually do feel guilty for watching it, is Keeping Up with the Kardashians. I am an expert in all things Kardashian. And they just constantly get tossed salads in their little plastic things that they like shake. They like vigorously shake them. It's like a meme, a Kardashian. It does, you know what? Nothing's ever mattered less. Let's talk
priorities.
About actually. Yeah. Let's talk about actually interesting news. Shakeups. DC, what is happening at DC? What has happened?
Huge shakeup that is. So earlier this week, DC Comics and DC Universe, the streaming service focused on DC content, were just the center of attention after a massive round of layoffs. And we're talking massive. You've got some big executives who exited. You've got DC's editor-in-chief, Bob Harris, you've got Mark Doyle, you know, senior story editor Brian Cunningham, all very respected people in the comics space. You've had a lot of streamlining that happened at the DC Universe team, marketing, other staffers. I mean, really just some major bloodletting that happened, which I think is very telling of what Warner Media's strategy, Warner Media, of course, is the parent company, what the strategy is for DC Comics going forward and all the questions that it raises about exactly what are comics' place, what is the place of comic books, actually, in the overall scheme of things.
Yeah, that was the part that was... because to an extent, it's a huge bummer, but you can see where there would be some kind of overlap between DC Universe, which was DC's streaming service, and HBO Max. It does sort of feel like if you're looking at all of these properties on paper that, yeah, maybe HBO Max should sort of absorb the properties that DC Universe was holding on to. Again, it sucks, but you can see from like a corporate organization standpoint where that would make sense. The firings on, or the parting of ways, I guess, on the publishing side, that feels kind of alarming. And I can't tell if it should be, if it's just a change of direction or, but it feels kind of alarming for comic books. I mean, this is DC. This isn't like some, this is, you know, It's DC. Firing your editors seems drastic and a little scary. Is that right?
It does. It's actually a big statement, I think, on where the priorities are and maybe what the future of comic books might be in the overall scheme of things. Of course, Sci-Fi Wire has confirmed that Jim Lee will remain in his position at DC Comics, although that position will sort of expand a little bit to include supervising the creative side on all future DC related initiatives. He'll also be the liaison between DC and other Warner divisions, but he will no longer be publisher. So in terms of having some kind of a continuity, having Jim Lee there, I think is a very positive sign. But what else this says about what this means for the future of comic books within the overall corporate structure, I think that is up in the air. There's just been a lot of sort of speculation, especially since one of the people who was let go was Mark Doyle, who really just helped spearhead and really champion the DC Black Label imprint, which is, of course, DC's specialty imprint for more mature readers. But it's also been a bit of a magnet for controversy because, you know, you've got storylines, you know, like Batman Damned from last year, you know, that had the infamous bat penis.
We had the full frontal from Batman, right? Yeah,
exactly. But I think that's the kind of very sort of envelope pushing storytelling that DC has been known for when it's able to really fire on all cylinders. And you've got, this is the publisher of, you know, The Dark Knight Returns and mm-hmm. Watchmen and, you know, The Sandman. If you look at it, all of those were huge risks at the time that they were released and yet have become real touchstones for comic book fans everywhere. So I think the question now really becomes, what is the future of comic books within this overall corporate structure? Our resident comics expert, Mike Avila, put together
a great piece up.
Very interesting sort of investigative piece into what this all means. And, you know, Mike was able to speak with a few sources. And one of the more interesting takeaways we have from that is that we have a source telling us that it seems that Warner Media probably doesn't want to be in the comics business. It wants to be, quote, in the character business. And when you look at things from that lens, suddenly you realize, well, you know, Superman doesn't necessarily have to reside in the comics. You can spin him off into a million other things in many other Warner Media properties. You know, you can spin him off into a new movie, something in Justice League, something animated, perhaps something that you show on HBO Max. So I think looking at these characters as having a life beyond the page is really looking at them really as properties and franchises that are now independent of their roots as comic book characters.
Yeah, that is super interesting. And I read Mike's piece, which is great. And everyone should, if you're at all interested in what's going on at DC, you should check it out because Mike is just one of those, he just kind of knows everyone and he has a ton of information. In the context of what you're saying that they don't want to be in the comics business, Warner wants to be in the character business, I guess it makes sense. But when you look, like you were saying, at all the successes, and I'm thinking particularly of Joker, the successes from DC have almost universally been in their more adult, more sophisticated, at least on the film side, storytelling. And the places where they've kind of faltered are, I guess I shouldn't say that, because then you have Wonder Woman, which was very funny and kind of heartwarming, but they've just had so much success in that being a little edgier than Marvel. So it's so strange that there would be firings there. And I think it's such a bummer. It makes a lot of sense when you look at it in this kind of cold-blooded way. Okay, you know, these characters are just IP. Who cares where it comes from? But there's a market for physical comic books and the experience of comics, and that's how you build an audience. And it just seems like, it seems to me a little bit short-sighted, but I am also not a media executive, so I don't know.
I think you have a great point there, Jackie. I think the question really becomes, you know, how much of a priority are comic books, and how will that be able to feed the stories in the pipeline I mean, if you really look at it, the most groundbreaking stories that have become some of the best story arcs in a lot of the films we've seen really originated in the comics, you know, and these are seminal and really just milestone storylines that continue to be mined today. I mean, Crisis on Infinite Earths, I mean, that is just so rich and so deep, and that was released in 1985, and yet it still resonates today. So I think and I hope that Warner Media and the DC Brain Trust will continue to recognize that, sure, you're going to have great storytellers telling stories directly for film, directly for TV, directly for streaming, but let's not forget the magic that happens when some of those stories actually come from the very source material that birthed these superheroes in the first place, which is the comics medium.
Maybe it'll be for the better, but I will just have to wait and see. Another set of beloved creators at Netflix, Avatar The Last Airbender, not James Cameron Avatar, but Avatar The Last Airbender also saw several exits. Well, two, really. And this is a series that I feel like has only really recently, I know it's been around and people have been a fan for a long time, but I've been hearing about it so much in the past month. I think everyone's just kind of at home discovering new things to watch, and Netflix is probably serving up Avatar The Last Airbender via whatever algorithms they have. But yeah, two major exits there too.
And two very shocking exits. I mean, let's not forget that, you know, Avatar The Last Airbender has such a rabid fan following, and it's just continued to grow. I mean, I will say a friend of mine discovered it through her daughter, who I think is, you know, 19 or no, I think she's about 22 now. And my friend was telling me that she and her daughter make that sort of their weekly, actually, no, I think it's their daily date. Like they actually sit and end the day by watching an episode, you know, of the series. Of the animated series.
That's so
nice. And, you know, I think it speaks so much to the power of the storytelling, the longevity that it has, you know, to be able to just pull in new generations of fans who are much older and being brought into the fold by their children, by a younger generation. So that is the power of Avatar The Last Airbender. So the news that its original creators, Michael DiMartino and Brian Konietzko, I hope I pronounced his name correctly, sorry, Brian, have parted ways with Netflix over the upcoming live action series. You know, and that is still moving forward, you know, in conjunction with Nickelodeon. And, but yeah, it's a pretty big development. Supposedly they clashed with Netflix over creative differences. And this supposedly happened over the last 2 years. And, you know, it looks like everybody just decided to amicably part ways. What this means for the fans, though, is anybody's guess.
Yeah, I will say that it seems as amicable as creative differences can be, because I feel like in my experience, creative differences are the most contentious usually because they're deeply personal, generally.
But it's also a really interesting sort of like umbrella excuse, if you think about it, right?
Creative differences
could mean so many things to varying levels of contentiousness or amicability.
And varying levels of, my gut instinct is to always side with the creator, the artist, is to say, well, you know, it must have been some corporate entity refusing or putting, but it could be budgetary constraints. It could, you know, there could be a lot of things could fall under the umbrella of creative differences. And maybe we'll get like dribs and drabs in the coming weeks of exactly what those differences were. But it's pretty dramatic to exit something so successful that you are the creator of. And in Instagram posts, they made it pretty clear that whatever happens now is not, might not be bad. In fact, might be good, but is not their vision. So it seems like they were probably true creative differences in terms of, you know, it's the story, it's the characters, it's the development, whatever it is. Why those differences exist, I mean, you could probably get 10 different stories from 5 different people. Like,
no, you're absolutely right. But also it's a really, it's a bit of a deja vu, I think, for fans, because let's not forget that Avatar: Last Airbender did have a live-action version. It was a movie directed by M. Night Shyamalan that was not very well received.
Right.
So it's understandable that this could create some anxiety with fans wondering, you know, with the exit of the creators, does this mean that the vision, like you said, may not stay true to the show that fans fell in love with?
Yeah. Who knows? I mean, people keep watching. I have seen some people tweeting that they will absolutely not keep watching, but I think fans will at least stick around to see what happens for a few episodes or seasons. But another big, I guess, in a way, an exit, if you consider leave not being in the Javits Center, I think everyone kind of saw this coming, but New York Comic Con is going to be virtual, as San Diego Comic Con was a few weeks ago. But they will not be having a convention at the Javits Center this year, which is a bummer, but also, I mean, I think very expected and reasonable and rational. And there's was an announcement of a fan portal, and yeah, it's we're gonna be at home in October still. So,
Well,
you know?
everybody saw this coming a mile away. I mean, I think the
Yeah.
question was, you know, why did it take so long for Reed
Yeah.
Pop, which organizes New York Comic Con, to finally make that announcement and make that decision? I mean, of course, you know, knock on wood, the numbers in New York have remained
Yes.
stable, but that's not necessarily the case in the rest of the country. And I think something like San Diego Comic Con, New York Comic Con, those cons really thrive because of the fan experience, because of the sense of community that happens, which means you have people coming from everywhere. And whether or not that is a wise decision where we are at overall, I think this certainly is a good solution going virtual. One thing that I think is interesting to note is that New York Comic Con is kind of distinguishing itself from Comic Con at Home, which is, of course, the San Diego version of it, which happened last month. But New York Comic Con is distinguishing itself by touting its panels as being live panels, live Q&As, a live experience. And even better, NYCC is partnering with YouTube on this. So hopefully that will mean a bigger bandwidth, a bigger footprint, maybe bigger opportunities for this to feel more like the live experience that fans are hoping to get or to replicate since they're going to be at home.
I love this. I think San Diego, they went first, so they didn't have the benefit of really seeing another large scale convention and what, live versus pre-taped, all of the pitfalls and benefits of each option. After everything's been kind of wrapped and done, I do wish it had been live. I am very excited for New York Comic Con to be live. And they had more lead time, I think. Like you said, they've probably known for months, particularly because New York was so hard hit so early that we were not going to be able to have a convention. I mean, the Javits Center was a field hospital not that long ago. So ha the idea of
You're
having
right. You're
a con
absolutely
I mean,
right.
that's crazy. So the idea of having a convention there while the pandemic is still obviously still ongoing in parts of the country are just now spiking and peaking. It was crazy. I am excited that it will be live. I think it's smart. I also think I wonder how much of a factor it was that New York Comic Con has always been a little bit more driven by television, just because it's the fall, we've got fall premieres, then films, summer blockbusters. San Diego is close to LA and it's in July. So I wonder if they're just a little more willing to take risks, if it's just, I don't know, they're married a little bit more to TV, which is a little bit more like streaming. So
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, in fact, if you look at the preliminary lineup that we've already got here, it sounds like we've already got a slew of networks that are on board. I mean, you've got Starz with American Gods, you've got the Star Trek universe from CBS All Access, and you've got DreamWorks Animation, Hulu, FX. I mean, those folks are already on board. So it is exactly like what you said. It looks like the con is leaning into its strengths, which is really being able to draw in some huge TV shows and some huge TV talent. And hopefully that's what is going to get this to really take off.
I'm really excited. And I hope that by being live, there's even more opportunity to engage fans in the moment, more live tweeting, more, you know, whatever it is. If there are like chat rooms, kind of old school AOL slash like Twitch style chat, I hope that they take that opportunity to have it really feel like an event that you're going to, even though you're on your couch, but incorporate fans. I think there's so many cool opportunities to use technology and use new platforms. And that was the biggest bummer of San Diego Comic-Con was it didn't feel like they really leaned into the chaos and saying like, all right, let's try something new because we can't do it the old way. So hopefully that's what happens.
Hopefully so. I think at the end of the day, people are just happy that there is some version of a con.
Totally.
I mean, let's think about it. I mean, they could have just canceled the whole thing altogether,
Yeah. You
know, and even just the complex exercise of pulling together all of these panels, pulling together all of the talent, you know, and recording that and editing that, much less
it's crazy.
Pulling it together as a live event. That's still pretty massive. And even if it's not in person, I think it really speaks to a lot of the hard work and a lot of the hustling that is going on behind the scenes to just make sure that, you know, we can try to get this to happen. So we'll see how it turns out. I'm pretty excited about it like you are.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great. And we'll end on it because we had a lot of like firings and shakeup kind of news. A piece of news, it was a very fun item on the site. The last Blockbuster in Oregon, well, it's anywhere, but it is in Oregon, is an Airbnb now that you can rent for sleepovers.
Isn't that nuts?
I think it's crazy. I have very strong feelings about it.
I mean, it's just insane that you can't rent any more Blockbuster, VHS tapes, but you can rent a Blockbuster location.
It does feel like someone was sitting around and was like, well, no one's renting videos, but what if they rented us? You know, and you're like,
I know, right? Rent the experience.
This is my feeling.
Rent the nostalgia.
I don't know if you have ever done this. In my life, I've had several experiences where I've had like kitschy sleepover. I'm thinking specifically of a Girl Scout trip to the Liberty Science Center, which is wonderful, but it was a sleepover. And also an old sailing ship in Mystic Seaport, Connecticut, which are like billed to you as like, oh, sleep in this place. The problem is it's not designed to sleep in. So it's really, really fun until the minute you turn the lights off and you're like, this actually sucks to sleep here. So I'm like, I think a Blockbuster would be so cool for like a party. Like rent it out for a part, but when I go to sleep, like I don't want to sleep in a Blockbuster video. That doesn't sound fun.
You know, you could always grab, you know, the boxes of the tapes or something and make that into a bed.
You could.
I gotta say, they're making this very, very attractive because it's only for I think it's 3 nights, but dig this, it's $4 a night.
That's
insane. That's like $4. I mean, that's like less than what, half of a hot dog from a concession stand in a movie theater?
It's probably less than it was to rent a video from Blockbuster. It was probably like $5 to rent. Oh no, they did all those like, you know, rent three, get one free. I don't know. It's very fun. It's very interesting. And I would totally do it for like a birthday party or something. Like
absolutely.
Let's do like a throwback birthday. It's very fun. I just feel very passionately about sleep comfort. That's also because I have a 6-month-old and I
Come on, who cares about comfort if you've got all these tapes that you can watch, which I guess will be just all 90s tapes?
Yeah, I guess.
Of 90s
movies. Oh my God, I can bring back a copy of Three Ninjas that I still have.
You totally can. You know, I will say though, I really hope that they don't close this location because
me too.
Sure, you know, I mean, it's like not pulling in any revenue or something, but the sheer nostalgia value of it,
come on,
I swear, it's sort of like, it's right up there already with like like Polaroids. You know what I mean? It's like, sure, does anyone really want to use it? But could we live without it? Of course not. You know what I mean? Like, we need that nostalgia. And Blockbuster just, you know, means so much to a lot of people who grew up in the 90s, you know, with this as an outlet before streaming and before everything else, you know, for people to be able to get their pop culture fix. Plus, you know, you've got movies like Captain Marvel that sort of bring Blockbuster back into the zeitgeist. You know what I mean? I just hope it never really goes away, because it's just like a really great, awesome slice of nostalgia.
Me too. I hope it sticks around. I hope it gets rented out every night and there's a million fun sleepovers and kids rediscover how fun rewinding tapes is, or just pulling the, you know, the spool out, whatever it is. It's very, very fun. I just feel passionately.
Exactly.
But it's very fun.
Our parting words for everybody should be kind, rewind.
Yes. Oh my God. Be kind, rewind. I remember that. Be kind, rewind, and then throwing it in the slot and being like, I think I just broke it in the return slot. at the library. Guys, be kind, rewind, and listen to the podcast over again if you feel like it. Alexis, thanks so much, as always, for chatting about all of the headlines. And hopefully next week, all of our news is hiring, new comics. New indie comics are hiring, and there's jobs for all artists and publishers and writers. That's my hope for next week.
Next week, we'll be reporting from the Blockbuster location.
Oh my God, yes. Oh, when this pandemic is over. That sounds like a very fun remote location to record the podcast from.
We're in.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
We're back from our little break there, and I'm here with Brian Silliman. We're going to talk all about Star Trek Lower Decks. Brian, is it fair to say that you are the biggest Star Trek fan in the universe?
No. No, I don't think so. I'm a huge enthusiast, and I am a very big fan. But I mean, I didn't grow up with Trek like a lot of people. I got into it a little later. It was when Deep Space Nine first came on.
Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, and that's why that's still my favorite of the Treks, because that's the one I watched first, and then that was kind of the gateway to everything else. And as I got really into that, that led me into TNG, led me into the movies, and it pretty much was downhill from there. It depends, you know, because it depends on what itch I need to scratch, Jackie. You know, if I'm in a science fantasy mood, you know, I go with Star Wars is its own thing. If I'm in a Star Wars mood, I go for Star Wars. You know, nothing is quite like that. If I'm in a fantasy mood, then obviously, you know, that's its whole other thing. But for science fiction, you know, if I want some science fiction in my life, it's either, you know, usually with me, it's either Trek or Doctor Who or Battlestar or any other host of stuff. So I'm just endlessly celebratory, even when it's, you know, it's not all of it's my favorite. You know, not every Trek show is my favorite. Not every episode is my favorite, but there's always something to like. And even if I don't personally like an episode, it's bound to be somebody's favorite.
I want to ask you about where you would, in the pantheon of all things Star Trek, where you would put Star Trek Lower Decks, which, to be fair, is only one episode in. You've seen more than one episode, correct?
Yeah. Well, the second came out this past week, so everyone has the first two. I've seen the first four. And it's interesting because this is obviously it's animated, so it immediately stands apart. It's something Trek has really only had one animated series following the original, with that had the voices of the whole original cast. They did a couple.
And it skews slightly older, right? Like it doesn't. Yeah. It's not for children.
It's a little lighter in tone than the original series, but it's definitely picking up on that. It gets a little more weird. Like you have weirder aliens. Mm. In that series. And then with Short Treks, they had two animated installments of that, which were fantastic. This is a completely different thing. I mean, this is Mike McMahon, who created it, is a veteran from Rick and Morty and Solar Opposites. And this is definitely more comedic. So it's not, high ethical dilemma Trek or anything like that. It's first and foremost, it's fun. That's going to rub a lot of fans the wrong way, and it already is. But first, I'll say in terms of Trek premieres and the way Trek premieres start, I think it starts very solid. I mean, in terms of it's new. It's part of the new Discovery/Picard era Trek. So immediately you just lost, you know, a lot of fans that way who just hate everything new with Star Trek immediately. But I'll say that. You look at how a lot of these shows started. You look at the first season of The Next Generation. It's not the best, is it? You know, it sucks.
No, and I feel like we, especially now, when there was just less TV to choose from, I think pilots are notoriously difficult, and first seasons of shows are usually finding their footing. And I think in general, people just have less patience for that because there's so much more to choose from. You don't have to slog through an all right first season with a promising premise. So I'm glad to hear you say that you feel the pilot and the start is strong, because that generally bodes well for the rest of the show.
Yeah, I mean, it started strong for me. I'd say I watched the first four episodes back to back to prep to talk to some of the cast. And
right.
I'll say that for me, I was enjoying it, and it was around episode three, I was really enjoying it. And then episode four, and I won't say what it is, obviously, but it gets really, there's a moment that is really, really weird. And the Ooh. Thing is, because this is animated, you know, Trek is always about strange new worlds and new civilizations. So I'm always, for me, I'm always waiting for it to get really weird. It's like, but every alien you meet, because you're limited by prosthetics and SFX and stuff like that, there's still kind of, you know, some manner of human being with something weird on their head. If it's like ridges or something that looks like a spoon or something they can't do. And that's where science fiction animation, such as a show like Rick and Morty, has really excelled, which is, it's not so hidden. But the real strength of that show, aside from it being hysterically funny, is because it's really good science fiction. And so this show is able to do that and get really weird and show you really weird stuff that live action can't do, and also go completely berserk with action and everything else in a way that live action can't do.
Right, would make a live action show unproducible.
Yeah, and it's funny along the way, but all of it is within the Trek universe. So it's aliens, you know, and it's terms, you know, and they can make fun of so many Trek and celebrate so many Trek cliches. And it's really said it before, it was really comforting when I watched all four. It just, you know, it was a bad day, and you know, a lot of days aren't great now, you know, so yeah. Shocker, I'm sure. And it just felt like this nice blanket of I was like, that was just a really nice time. And I'll say that I wanted more. I'm like, I watched those four and I'm like, now I would have watched 50.
So I want to ask you a little bit more about, because I saw some of this speculation in anticipation of the show coming out, the fan reaction and your reaction to And I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this, because it obviously, like you said, it's part of the Trek universe, but it seems of all of the Trek spinoffs, doing an animated comedy geared more toward adults feels like it is tonally, potentially not in the air quote Trek universe, in the sense that Star Trek is usually very earnest. It could be watched by a family of all ages, which maybe is true of Lower Decks as well. But when I hear like comedy creator of Rick and Morty, I kind of automatically think like, okay, this is like TV 14.
I mean, in a way it does skew, you know, some of the jokes, but it's kind of in the way that the Simpsons, you know, the jokes are on multiple levels.
Yeah.
It's adults will get certain references. Kids will not.
It's not like inappropriate, but does that. So when you're watching it, and even the title of the first episode is Second Contact, right? Which is sort of like, it's a pretty obvious like wink nod. If you don't know what First Contact is, you've not really seen Star Trek. But does it ever, I guess what I'm asking is, verge into satire or like pointing a finger? Or does it just feel like what you were saying, this enveloping kind of like, oh, it's all, we love the original stuff?
Yeah, for me, it doesn't point that finger. And I'll say, like, it's not a spoof. That may differ based on watching it. I'm not saying that's, you know, commandment. I'm just saying for me, it doesn't read a spoof.
And I don't think that's good or bad. Like, love Star Wars and Spaceballs. You know,
yeah,
like, you can love them both.
And I love both. And I would have accepted if it was. I mean, what this does so well is this is a look. It's like, let's apply... This is not the captain and the main crew. What is the regular people on this ship? What are their lives like? And logically, within this kind of, when you get right down to it, life on this starship would be a little more than a little absurd. So let's have some fun with that, kind of in a very, you know, Douglas Adams kind of way. And that doesn't spoof it. If anything, it's fun, but it's not pointing the finger. And this, not only are the characters are capable, but they're very earnest about why they love this and everything else. Tawny Newsom is amazing as the main character. Yeah, there are references here and there and a lot of references and Easter eggs, but it doesn't feel spoofed to me. It's still, you know, taking place in a specific period in the Trek canon. It's still post Star Trek Nemesis, way before Picard. And you're just on a different ship. I mean, not every ship is the Enterprise. This is, you know, not the Federation flagship. So it's, what is it like on all of these other ships for when you're not privy to the senior staff stuff? You all sleep pretty much in bunks in a hallway and you wake up and you get your assignment is to be in this Jeffries tube all day. You know, are you excited or are you not? You know, and through that logical lens of the things we've already seen is, what is that like? And a lot of times it's really absurd and it's fun. And so in terms of it necessarily being canon, you know, I don't know if it'll add a lot to the overall story of Trek. They have said that there will be guest stars coming, familiar faces or whatever, because we're in that time period. There are multiple people they could bring on. But I'll say this in terms of whether it's for adults or kids. I have a number of Trek acquaintances, Trek colleagues, you could say, that I've met at various events over the years, and more than a few of them have, their kids have not wanted anything to do with Trek ever.
Because it's something that mom and dad like, and that's just it, fundamentally uncool.
Yeah.
Like, mom and dad like it. No, thank you.
Yeah. They couldn't get them involved. And so they, but they showed them this, and the kids, you know, of varying ages, either little or, you know, middle school or something like that, loved this. And then because it's not, here's the whole season, because they're going episode by episode, it's like, well, I want more of this. It's like, okay, well, here's this movie. And now here's, you know, Next Generation. And now these kids can't get enough of, you know, Next Generation or Voyager or something else. And now they're Trek fans because this was their gateway. You have the First Contact, and as you mentioned, and that's great. And that's what the movie's about. But then there's a lot of paperwork that follows up after that, isn't there? It's like the whole idea of Second Contact is, well, now we have to go and iron out the details. And the thing is, with this crew, they find ways to, you know, screw that up and make that into, it's actually entertaining.
Well, I think that you brought up kind of in as an example of something else, but it does a little bit put me in mind of what I enjoy so much, particularly about the first season of Battlestar, which is it sort of asks the question, like, it gets at that sci-fi question a little bit, I think, where, okay, yeah, we've got Star Trek and Picard and the Enterprise. There's that slice of spacefaring and sci-fi and drama. But also, those ships would get old and shitty and get retired, and their admirals would age, and their crew would maybe, like, not necessarily be battle-ready. And I think Battlestar maybe obviously goes in very different directions, but those first few episodes kind of take a look at what that might look like from a very dramatic perspective. And it sounds like Lower Decks answers from a comedic perspective, okay, but what is the rest of the fleet doing? What are the not so great ships doing? What are the workaday? I think that's like a very underused trope or question in sci-fi. Like, we want to focus on the king. We want to focus on like the cowboy, the admiral. We don't necessarily care about the dude who's responsible for like wiping down the holodeck, you know?
Right. And that's, I mean, the whole inspiration for this show was the seventh season Next Generation episode, which is called Lower Decks, which focused on four ensigns, you know, out for promotions and not being privy to those conversations and, you know, looking from the outside in. And the power of that episode was you as the audience felt like, wow, what is it like to sit across 10 forward and look at Riker and Troy having a conversation and wondering what they're talking about?
Being like, we didn't where know. Are we going now? Come on, can we just hang out for like a week?
Right. And desperate to impress them.
Yeah.
And they have their little, you know, ensign poker game as well. Just like the other officers. So that was really the inspiration for this whole show. And that's, you know, it's also a quite a good episode. But aside from that, it's kind of not only is the focus on them, it's the Cerritos, which is the ship here. It's and Don Lewis plays Captain Freeman. You do get to meet the senior staff a little. You meet her. You meet the first officer, who's played by Jerry O'Connell. I mean, their chief medical officer is Acacian, which is this cat alien that debuted in the animated series, and immediately is okay. That's amazing, and it's kind of the best, my favorite character in some ways. The ship itself, like you've said, is not, we're in a fight. We need someone to send against, we have one ship that's sent against the Borg right now. You're not going to send the Cerritos, at least not now. The opening credits have this, it's full of little bits, but one of them is the Cerritos flies up and there's a fleet of Romulans fighting a fleet of Borg. And it takes one little hit on the shields and it just turns around and just warps away. It's pretty much, okay, you guys handle this. We want no part of whatever this shit is going on. We're just going to leave. And that's pretty, that image is kind of this show. And is that, you know, I'm sure there are some, it's like, well, that's not Starfleet. Starfleet would never do that. They'd never run from a fight. It's like, well, some of them probably would.
Yeah, some of them would.
Yeah, the Enterprise runs into, you know, ships that, and crew members and crazy admirals and evil members of Starfleet all the time that are you know, less than that are not at their standards. You know, not every ship is the Enterprise. Not every captain is Benjamin Sisko. And Voyager, I mean, you look at that show. It's like when they meet another ship that was stranded, that captain did not follow the ideals that Janeway did. And they go flat out evil. I mean, Starfleet also has Section 31 and stuff like that, where it's not even running from a fight. It's, you know, using genocidal tactics. So we're well past the Ship of Saints era that Roddenberry envisioned. We've been past that for a long time.
I love that. Okay. And then I'm going to draw one more comparison that feels apt to me, but maybe it's crazy. And it feels a little bit to me, and again, from a dramatic perspective, and this is what I like and what I enjoy about these one-off spin-offs, these series and movies and shows that let us kind of poke at the borders of what is and isn't Star Trek, or in this case, Star Wars. That's what Rogue One felt like to me. You've got a character like Cassian Andor, who, you know, we paint the Rebels, or the movies ask us to view the Rebels as heroes, saints. They're saving they don't wouldn't say democracy, but that's, you know, basically the idea, saving democracy or fighting for democracy. And then you immediately have Cassian Andor in the first few scenes killing an ally because it's expedient. It's what makes sense. And he's following orders. And sometimes orders conflict with morality. And I think to some people that is like itchy in a way, like, what? I don't want to see a morally compromised good guy. And it feels like, yeah, let's do more of that. We've got these franchises that have these well-established boundaries and heroes and villains. Let's like mess it up a little. That's the part that makes it feel like adult, I guess, to me, is like, let's see what happens when we focus on other parts of this well-known universe and franchise.
Yeah, you see in the second episode, the captain's walking down the hallway and she's saying, I need a cool way to say, let's go to warp. Should it be warp time? Or she's like, she's pretty much trying to find her engage, you know?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
so she's like, we need these, we don't have these cliches yet, so we want, so it's kind of what you're saying, but it's definitely a more comedic approach, and like I said, it's, well, the logical extension, like you said, so who's the person who cleans the holodeck? You actually do see that.
Really?
Yes, that is a job that someone has to do, and the thing is, they're competent, but in different ways. You think,
yeah.
Ensign Mariner is kind of has no ambition or whatever else. She does have ambition, but it's of a different kind, as Tawny Newsome, when talking to her, said. She just doesn't care for the Starfleet red tape, but she'll definitely get the job done, just not by the rules. And I will say it's comedic, but it also, it has a lot of, the heart of it is definitely still Trek, and that's, it's not cynical. And it's that's what makes the difference. It loves the Trek universe, and it has all the characters have heart, and that's what makes it Trek for me. If it didn't have that, then it would feel more like a spoof and more like a ripoff or whatever. But it has that Trek heart. Even when the characters aren't quite living up to it, the show is aware of it. And I really hope people give it a chance, because not just in terms of first seasons of Trek, already it's very strong. I mean, I'd say in terms of Trek, first seasons don't have a great track record. Animated shows in general are a little rocky at the beginning, aren't they? You know, the first couple episodes of every great animated series, not all of them have been have had amazing premieres, to say nothing of first episodes. It takes a little while to find their footing. And Mike McMahon has said, he's like, even, you know, it took a few episodes to kind of get our groove. And by the end, it kind of really started to gel. And so I really hope fans give it a chance, mostly because I want more of it.
Yeah.
I want it to stay on for a long, long time. So that's my real reason, because I hope fans take to it and just, you know, be a little patient. And it was made, honestly, and I'm not being paid by anyone to say this, so I'm not a shill, or trust me, I'm not on anyone's payroll. I just really hope people give it a chance. There is love here. And if it's not for you, then it's not for you. I mean, that's fine. It's not your Trek.
There's plenty of other Trek to enjoy.
Yeah, Lord knows. There's, you know, it's all there. So then watch one that, but you know, it's
watch Picard, watch Next Generation.
Watch and watch DS9 for the third time. All streaming somewhere. I mean, but I will say it's, you know, it's made with love from the creator and the cast. Just so much improvisation going on.
It's very comedy first in terms of the cast.
Yeah.
Who you actually, we should say, you got to speak to some of the cast. Is that is going to be on sci-fi.com, the recap or the interview that you actually had with them, right?
Yeah, it's in the two forms. The feature with Mike McMahon and Tawny Newsome is on Sci-Fi Wire, the site, the written piece, and the latest episode of Warp Factor is actual the video interviews with Noelle Wells, Eugene Cordero, Tawny Newsome, Mike McMahon, and Jerry O'Connell. If you look up, go on YouTube and look up Sci-Fi Wire Warp Factor, you'll find our Warp Factor page and you could find those interviews. But I mean, one of the, I don't think it made it into the actual episode of Warp Factor, but Tawny Newsome says, he's like, the rule is generally, because she says she goes into the booth, drinks all of the free coffee there is, and just goes nuts. And the general rule is, say the scripted lines three times.
Yeah.
And then she just goes nuts. And she's like, you wind up with some utter nonsense. And she herself is baffled by how much of it actually ends up in the show. And it's gold.
I love that.
Because she has so many little grace notes and little songs and little ditties and little call outs and everything. And I was like, it just sounds so spur of the moment, especially with all of them, but especially with her. And she is just, what a talent. They're all really wonderful, and they all care, and they want to add positive things to Trek. They are not the devil. So, I mean,
they're not.
Neither is he. You know, Mike McMahon, the creator. I mean,
no. Very few people actually are the devil.
Yeah.
Very few creators are like, you know what? Now that I've worked my whole life to be a part of this beloved franchise, I'm going to shit all over it.
Right.
That's been my goal the whole time.
It's like, at last, my plan has succeeded. Yes. I mean, first off, why?
The longest, most difficult con ever run.
Yeah.
I'm going to work my ass off. And then in my early 40s, I'm going to get to helm the animated version of a Star Trek spinoff, and I'm just gonna take a wet dump all over it.
I can't wait, and I'm gonna make everyone so miserable.
That's my plan.
And I can't wait because 2020 is not near miserable enough. So I'm gonna ruin Trek forever, and then it's gonna be so bad that they're gonna retroactively take everything off of streaming, and Trek will have never existed.
Uh-huh.
And it's just gonna be
And then you know what? They're gonna give it to me. They're gonna give me all the unedited footage, and I'm gonna put in a bunch of Jean-Luc Picard farting and Riker. All right, guys.
It's like, you know what? Spock doesn't fart enough. Well, guess what? Fixed it.
My edit. All he does is fart. They're going to call it the Silliman cut, and it's just farts. Sadly, we do have to end on that note. And we were just getting cooking. But check out Brian's piece talking to some of the casting creators on sci-fi.com. And also on YouTube, and watch all the episodes of Warp Factor because they're very fun. I thought they were on social media too, but I thought Instagram and Twitter.
Shorter installments are on Twitter and Instagram. For the full thing, you can find it on YouTube. And a shout out to our Juan Cadavid and our entire and Sean and JC, our entire amazing Warp Factor team who take my rambling idiocy and put it all together. If you like that show, it's because of them. It has nothing to do with me.
Yeah. Shout out to the producers. Brian, that's our episode. And luckily, you're here for the moment that we've all been waiting for. When I get to crown who won the week this week. I know who I think won the week, but I'm going to let you go first. Do you have a winner of the week? It can be truly anything. I've crowned concepts and I think like individual clouds I've seen. It can be really whatever you want. It's not.
I love this. You know, I'm finding it very hard. I don't know if this is the case with you, but to finish a book.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I've been reading the same book since March.
I have about 6 books going right now because my mood keeps changing.
Sure.
I don't know like which one to pick up or what. And I keep having to reread stuff or whatever else. But I will say contenders, I'd say Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but that just made it ended.
Oh, great.
That just made me sad.
Okay.
And so that is winning nothing, even though it was a really solid finish. I haven't even gotten into the final Tales of Arcadia series, even though I love Guillermo del Toro and his whole team on that, because it's towards the end and I can't, you know, I don't want to say goodbye to that either. I'll just say there's this book. I'm reading Charlie Kaufman's book.
Oh, called, God, my husband just bought that. And I was like, what is this? Fucking Infinite Jest Part 2, but it's huge.
You know, it's a little more accessible than Infinite Jest, but it's kind of, man, is it not, it's called Ant Kind, as you probably already know, and man, is it not good for quarantine, but it kind of is because you're just in Charlie Kaufman's head and all of the problematic nature and the masturbatoriness as well as the brilliance and the craziness, it's all there. And if you are a Charlie Kaufman fan already, then it's he's already doing things, and I'm like 150 pages in or whatever. And I'm at the point where it's now hooked me.
That's a full book. Speaking of rough first seasons, that's 150 pages is the length of some books. You read a book, and then you're like, I'll continue with the book that this book is
like,
part of.
You know what's going to go great with that book? More book.
More book.
So I'll just say that this is kind of, even it's taking over my mind sometimes, where there are certain,
sure.
it's rare that you're reading a book that a passage or a line of character says will make me laugh out loud. And that has happened, especially when it's not a comedy.
Yeah.
And that has happened a couple times now in this book. So I'll say personally, that's winning the week for me right now, as well as the general return of Charlie Kaufman. Now that they've put a lot of his movies back on streaming, even though I own them in multiple formats, cause I'm a huge fan of him. His work has been separated from us for too long. So the return of him in any form is, and of course it's like, you're a great screenwriter. Of course, you know how to write this insane prose that is so, of course you can do that too. It's like, man, it's, but I'll say I'll go with that.
Okay. So Charlie Kaufman specifically, Aunt Kind. I am going to go with, and this will make more sense in the context of the news piece with Alexis, but I am going to go with sleeping in your own comfortable bed. Well, I don't know if you saw, there was a story up on the site, Blockbuster, in the last Blockbuster, which is in Oregon, is now an Airbnb, and I have strong feelings about kitschy sleeping experiences, generally, that I don't like them. So I am going to go with sleeping in your own comfortable bed, that I worked hard to make money to pay for a comfortable bed, and I prefer to sleep in that bed as opposed to anything else in the world.
Does Alexis want to sleep over in the Blockbuster?
If I had to guess, knowing Alexis a little bit, I think he'll think it's a cool experience and that I will have a very strong reaction
Oh man, part of me really wants to go and see it, but part of me also is like, a sleepover in the last Blockbuster. It's like I wouldn't want to do it alone. The whole idea of a sleepover right now seems like an adventure, like of Tolkien proportions, because it's like, wow, other people?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
It's
like, sign me up right now. So even just you had me actually you had me at other place.
Other place. Yeah. Anywhere. You know what? That's what wins the week, is anywhere else. It always ends a little depressing.
Anywhere else.
It always ends a little depressing. Okay,
I went to the dentist this past week and it was amazing.
It was incredible. I'm sure. Incredible. I haven't even done that. Guys, that's our episode. That's who won the week. I want to thank Alexis for joining me and breaking down the headlines. Brian for joining me and talking about Lower Decks. As always, subscribe to Sci-Fi Wire on all social media, Twitter, Instagram. Check out sci-fi.com for all your geek news. And of course, watch Warp Factor with Brian.